Hello and welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. I'm Craig DL, I'm the Head of Policy and Research at Commonweal. And this week I'm joined by a special guest, Kevin Anderson, who was a member of the evidence group of the Scottish Climate Assembly. Now, this Climate Assembly is something that we talked about on the podcast just a few months ago, back in March, when we spoke to Ian Stewart and Ellie Clark. Ellie was one of the citizen members of the Assembly. They talked about the experience of being on the Assembly, and they talked about the process of setting up the Assembly. But now, last week, as we record this, the Assembly has published its final report with 82 recommendations for the Scottish Government. So, Kevin, hello, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here. Nice to join you.
Hi. Can we just start by talking a little bit? Just introduce yourself and how you got involved with the Assembly.
Okay. Well, I'm Kevin Anderson. I'm a professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester. And I suppose it's because I've got that background of working on energy and climate change that I was contacted by some of the Scottish Assembly members to say, would I like to be part of the evidence group, trying to collect together the information that the members would get to hear? And so I think given that background and sort of my engagement with these issues is why the Scottish Secretariat came to me to ask me to join. And it's probably also worth noting that I did spend 10 years working in the petrochemical industry, quite a lot of that actually offshore in Scotland.
Oh, we won't hold that against you.
There were lots of good people working offshore.
No, many of my friends have worked in the industry, and I almost went down that path myself. As a very brief summary for listeners who maybe haven't listened to the previous episode on the Scottish Climate Assembly, this Climate Assembly is the second Citizens' Assembly for Scotland, following on from a more general Citizens' Assembly in 2019. This is a new way of really deliberative and active democracy, where you gather together a group of people who represent the population of Scotland. So this assembly was formed of about 100 people. They were randomly selected, but then that random selection was tweaked and balanced so that the people who ended up on the assembly were balanced across gender, across income, across age and location in the country. So you really end up with what's called a mini public representative of the country. And it's I was privileged enough to be one of those who were brought in to give a bit of evidence to the assembly. I came along for 3 weekends and presented a short video on my own position on what Scotland should do and various aspects of the climate emergency, and stayed around to answer questions and answers. And for me personally, it was a fascinating experience having this tiny little keyhole into these discussions. But Kevin, how did you find that process going back from sort of gathering together the various experts in the field and throwing them at the assembly?
Well, there were two parts of this for me in terms of feeling. The first part, and I always take the view that as an academic, I have to say it as I see it. And I think probably the most challenging part for me was some of the early discussions with some of my academic colleagues about who were the appropriate people to bring in for evidence and what sort of evidence we felt was appropriate for the members to get to hear. And although we always like to think, the evidence will be completely objective, of course, who you choose and so forth is an important part of painting a balanced picture. And there was quite a lot of healthy and courteous disagreement about the relevant expertise. But we settled down to a sort of quite a wide cohort of people. But that was quite a challenging process, but not that dissimilar to a lot of the ongoing discussions that we have as academics. But the next part of the process, actually getting involved with the members, was really uplifting. I suppose it's often as an academic, it's too easy to dismiss sort of like lay expertise, the way that that people who aren't an expert in a field might view it. But I think it's really key that we start to listen much more, particularly on issues that are very wide ranging. So something like, if you like, the climate change science, there's probably not a lot that the layperson can say about the actual science itself, but about what we should do about our commitments in terms of climate change and how we respond in terms of policies and who should the policies affect, issues of fairness and all this other side of things. Then they are absolutely key in understanding you know, that sort of terrain, if you like, that sort of policy landscape. And it's too easy, I think, for experts to dismiss lay members. And to me, that was really eye-opening, again, because every time I engage with the public, which I do quite a lot with my other work, I'm always sort of surprised just at how insightful a lot of the suggestions are.
Yeah, so how did you find the process of presenting the evidence to the Assembly in that regard? And did you find that these complex issues had to be broken down a lot? Or as you say, did you find a lot of folk just came in with quite a lot of knowledge? And did you see that, how helpful was that evidence to the members? Did you see that their opinions really being formed by these presentations?
Well, in the early weekends that we had with the members, I mean, a lot of the time it was really just sort of providing information for them to start to develop their own views from. Because I think the members would agree, with a few exceptions, that most of them had very little knowledge of the issues. And so to start with, it was a big learning curve for them. And I mean, I'm sure some people really struggled, but by and large, I was really amazed by how fast the members managed to pick up the nuances of the science, the policy landscape, the different things that we were asked to address within the Assembly. So that was really, again, quite a surprise to me how fast people could get together, get up with information. And that was partly because the way that we'd been asked as evidence leads to make sure that our information was accessible. And then there was often a Q&A afterwards, or a discussion afterwards with the members. And then the members would go away in their own sort of little breakout groups and discuss amongst themselves with someone there to guide them as well. So the whole process in that sense worked really well for them to get a good basis from which to start to develop their views. And I'm sure people had some sort of sense of what they thought was important in relation to climate change. But you could actually see, you know, people coming up with different or being surprised by some of the information they heard and then coming up with different suggestions as a result. So it was very much a learning process. I think a learning process for all, you know, as much the experts as it was for the lay members.
So, yeah, when we talk about we're going to talk about some of the policy recommendations in the report in a few minutes, but what can you say about the process of how those recommendations were formed and honed and then finally decided?
Yeah, well, we didn't really get on to thinking about the actual recommendations by the members until, you know, quite a long way through the process. And that was because, of course, they needed to have the information on which to develop their thoughts and their suggestions. So it was the later weekends when that started to happen. And it was quite an iterative process. They'd had all this information. They had to start to pull this together and quite quickly what came out, sort of certain themes that they would focus upon, and that was produced with some guidance with some of the secretariat members and so forth. So there were some set themes, and then people were in sort of, if you like, little expert breakout groups that would then focus on those particular themes, and they would come up with suggestions that would then go back, if you like, to plenary, to everyone else, to sort of talk about and discuss, and then again they'd be honed again. So there was a sort of an iterative process of going backwards and forwards from quite generic sort of suggestions, then tightening them up a bit further, then honing them, and then revisiting them again amongst the whole group, and then honing them again, until eventually comes some quite sort of specific suggestions that were really sort of aimed. These are the sort of things that the policymakers need to seriously think about in a sort of language that's appropriate for policymakers. So it was an ongoing process. There was no sort of top down in this. It was quite an emergent process.
Yeah, and is was this also a good process for finding a consensus or across disagreements?
Yes, but it certainly, I mean, the consensus occurred you can see the recommendations on many of the recommendations. They're the ones that we tend to pull out. But I also think we mustn't forget that there's real benefit when there isn't a consensus as well. So there were lots of other really wonderful suggestions that did not make it into the final document. And these suggestions were things that needed, there was some disagreement. But that disagreement itself is quite healthy. And I think there's actually something to be said that often disagreement occurs because maybe not enough information is there to provide some sort of sense of consensus. So I think whilst the final report is really focused on all the consensual elements that came out of that process, we mustn't dismiss the rest of it, where there's some really good suggestions that were not always popular with everyone.
Yeah, I can certainly think of a few examples in other areas of of policy and politics where I've been involved in a campaign that has initially started off, you know, either from a position of having no knowledge whatsoever about it. The example I often use is universal basic income. When I first started getting involved in that, it was one of these far radical ideas that were only the wildest of dreamers ever thought about universal basic income. Well, in Scotland now, we're in a situation where the Scottish Parliament is almost united in favour of a universal basic income. There's only one party in that parliament who's against it. And that's only in the process of less than 10 years.
Yeah, of course, I mean, that was one of the suggestions that came out within the final report. So it's interesting that whilst I thought that a lot of disagreement would occur from people's particular views on politics, so some people would be maybe more right-wing or more left-wing, whatever it might be, and that would actually colour the things that there was more consensus on or not. But it was actually quite a surprise there. And perhaps that's because Scotland is more unified than perhaps the UK is as a whole. But these what were quite sort of politically charged issues tended to have quite a high consensus to them, which I found again surprising. But I think that was probably more a product of being Scotland. I think probably you could have had something similar, say in perhaps something similar in Wales. But I think as the UK as a whole, you wouldn't have seen that degree of consensus emerging on what were really quite political issues.
Well, maybe the scientist in me tells me that's an excuse for more citizens' assemblies so we can test that hypothesis.
Well, I mean, certainly, as someone who went into this process healthily sceptical about their value, I came out of it thinking, actually, I think there's real scope for more citizens' assemblies. And there's certain things I learned from this process about how you could perhaps in the future. But like all of this, you know, we're in the early days of trying this as one of the tools of democracy, if you like.
Yeah, and I was going to get to this a bit later, but may as well discuss it now. Is this something that you could see as a becoming a regular part of democracy? Either this kind of citizen assembly where you have a topic, or maybe something similar to the 2019 assembly where you have a more general canvassing of views.
I certainly think so, but not without some reservations. There's a tendency in politics to try to, if you like, to sort of tailor such things to give the results that they want to hear. And I think we have to recognize there are real powers trying to do that. And that in producing something like a citizens' assembly, it's really essential that it is independent of government. It is independent of the establishment, and voices from all spectrums are allowed to be heard. I will perhaps be a little provocative here and say I don't feel the UK Climate Assembly had that degree of autonomy. I felt that was much, much more controlled by the establishment in a particular way, which I won't go into now, but I mean, it felt very much more like that. The Scottish one, though, was not as open as I would have, as ideally I would have liked, but it was nevertheless much more open than the UK one. So I think the Scottish one was a really good example of a progression towards what citizen assemblies should be. And as I say, as someone who's healthily sceptical about them to start off with, I think they have a real potential for us generating a much more open, engaged democracy, particularly at a time, I think, when there's a lot of disillusionment with democracy, which is sometimes misplaced. I think we're obviously unnecessarily cynical about some of our policymakers. I mean, certainly there's some many bad eggs in there, but there are also some wonderful people in politics. But I think perhaps opening up to the citizens' assemblies may actually allow us to think it was more about it being our democracy, which of course is ultimately what it is.
Yeah. No disagreement there. So let's talk about the recommendations themselves. I mean, as I say, there was 82 recommendations that made it into this final report and dozens that didn't. And I don't expect anyone to have an encyclopedic knowledge of every single policy in that report. Was there any there that you, Kevin, would caught your eye or you would like to highlight?
Some of the ones on buildings, and I think this is particularly pertinent to Scotland as well, were really interesting. the idea of this, a very rapid retrofit of all Scottish households that are going to be still there in, say, 2050, and not just a sort of a light touch retrofit with a bit of draft excluder so we can tick a box in some civil servant's in tray, but actually much more that, you know, there'll be deep retrofit to make sure that these properties were really good quality and that would help eliminate fuel poverty. It was also recognised to be a huge issue and is a particularly big issue in Scotland. And so I think retrofitting the existing houses was really important, but also that went along with ensuring that all new houses were passive house, or I think it might mean passive house plus, in other words, were built to such a level where you require almost no heating in those properties. Yeah. And we know how to do this. I mean, we've been doing it for years. I was recently visiting a number of houses when I was back in Sweden that had no heating for the last 14 years because they're a passive house. In Sweden, they are a cold country. So I think that this side was really important. There was and was well ahead of what the government were proposing. And I think that's, again, that plays out as it provides some sort of, hopefully provides some courage to the policymakers to stand up to the incredibly conservative sort of building industry. So it's been building the same sort of what I would call pretty low quality houses for decades. And it seems very reluctant to be dragged into the 21st century and saying, we need to be building properties for people that are both very low energy use and suitable for a changing climate as well. And so, hopefully these recommendations can really help the policymakers drive some policy agenda that will deliver much better properties within Scotland.
Yeah, and I should say that I'm actually in the process of organising an interview with someone who's in the building industry to talk about Passive House and the retrofitting challenge on a future podcast. So I'm actually really looking forward to that one.
Yeah.
For me, one of the ones that really popped out was, there was two, then I'm a bit biased because there were two topics that I spoke about when I was giving evidence, but I was so encouraged to see the ideas be adopted as enthusiastically as there were. One was for community tool libraries, where instead of having to buy power tools that then just sit in a shed or sit in a drawer for years not being used, we can just go down and borrow one whenever we need it. And the one thing that really caught my eye in the report was that the Assembly generalised that issue, not just tools, but a much broader selection of resources and goods and services that right now we often buy but don't use at a full capacity, so that therefore should maybe consider looking at borrowing or leasing instead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. That was really important. And I think that came out more widely in that whilst the members were asked really to look at issues to do with climate change, and this was to their real credit here, they saw climate change as one of a suite of other challenges, environmental challenges, sustainability challenges, but also issues of fairness and ethics within Scotland. And I thought that was really interesting because they weren't pushed in that direction, but that's one that very clearly emerged. So things like tool libraries, you wouldn't immediately think that has a very strong climate change implication, but it actually does when you start to think of the materials in making these tools. But I think even more importantly, it's something that fosters an attitude of sharing and an attitude of community, which sometimes means we can actually be much, much lower emissions. So I think it's not the individual policies, but the sort of collective mindset that was behind those policies and emerged through this process that I see as key in changing the dialogue and the way that we look at these issues.
Yeah. To just give a very rough example of how that can affect things in terms of materials. If you've got 10 folk all buying a cheap power drill, but instead they can each go to the tool library and borrow one really high quality professional grade power tool, everybody gets better power tools, but the power tool industry drops by 90% because you only need to build one instead of 10.
Yes. I mean, I've seen this in part because as a keen cyclist, I spend a lot of time, I actually work at a Swedish university as well. And there's a lot of places over there where you have these, you can go in with your bicycle and there's all the tools there to fix and repair your bike, including somewhere that can help you with it as well. So rather than everyone having their own little sort of bike workshop at home, you can just go into your local one in the middle of town. So you see that process actually at work there. So I'm all in favour of that. And it wasn't pulled out a lot within the recommendations here, but even you can imagine extending that to things like cars. And there's a lot more discussion around this sort of car sharing rather than necessarily owning your own car. So as we switched from petrol and diesel cars to electric vehicles, do we all need to have our own electric vehicle. I mean, we've got 32 million private electric vehicles in the UK and probably 40 million in total, including fleet cars. Do we all really need that again in electric versions, or should we just switch to maybe rental or some sort of local ownership model instead? So we can extend it from tools to other things as well.
Yeah, and that's something that's actually particularly concerns me in my own life, where I live in a house that doesn't have a driveway, but I also live in a street where there's actually quite limited space to park cars, and it's often very full. There's certainly not enough room to put in charging points for everybody's car. So if everybody in my street switched to electric vehicles, then it starts to become a bit of a struggle to work out how that actually works in practice.
Yeah, this is a pet subject of mine, which was brought up to some extent in the assembly, but it's just that now we've got this opportunity to rethink our transport system. So we'd really switch from a whole load of petrol and diesel cars in a queue, trundling along at 4 or 5 miles an hour to get people into work, or should we switch from that to electric vehicles all in a queue, trundling along at 4 to 5 miles an hour, or should we use this opportunity to rethink what transport in our urban and city and town environments should look like? And of course, we should be rethinking it. Sadly, at the moment, our policymakers are not doing that.
Yeah. I have been in discussions about and with various levels of Scottish politics, especially at the local authority level, where you start to see these discussions happening. You start to see them talking to the kind of people who are giving them these kind of ideas, but you're still seeing it happening in a very fragmented process where people might say the right things and they might talk to some of the right people, but you're still not seeing that grand overarching strategy. And even with the willingness to do something, not necessarily the willingness to do that specific thing that needs to be done. There's still a bit of a gap there.
There is indeed. I mean, it was actually interesting seeing some of the members' recommendations on things like an Oyster card for Scotland and having integrated rail. It's easy to say integrated rail, but I mean, integrated transport has been this great myth in the UK for all of my life. We still don't have it. The idea we have some sort of integrated transport network with an Oyster card, with much more active travel within our towns, and that we actually actively facilitate walking and cycling and so forth. These were all things that were pulled up very strongly within the assembly recommendations. So there's clearly an interest from the citizens of Scotland for a different transport agenda.
Do you think that is possibly what the big benefit of this assembly will be, and demonstrating that willingness from the public almost gives the politicians permission to do these things?
That is really key in this, is that what this has done is it's allowed the public to say, we're prepared to consider these things, so why aren't you considering them? And that gives the policymakers the courage to start to come up with things that are different to the business as usual, which is really what most policymakers seem to typically do, incremental adjustments to business as usual. But this actually says, no, we want you to come up with things that are much more we are prepared to accept more radical policies that would drive a change in how we live our lives in Scotland in a much more sort of positive, progressive fashion. And this doesn't does give that courage to, or helps give that courage to the policymakers. So yes, I'm really hoping that is the case. And perhaps, again, like you were saying before, we have more of these. You can imagine them focusing in, say, on transport. So you can have a citizen assembly that actually focused in on the transport issues within Scotland. And obviously, which are very different between the rural environments, and particularly Scotland with all the highland and island communities, and the city and urban environments.
So that kind of segues us into the last question and that I have to ask you today, is what happens to the report now? It's now been published. Where does it go from here?
Well, we're now waiting for the Scottish Government's response to the report. And hopefully that will come before the big international negotiation this year that's been held in Glasgow, which probably everyone hopefully is familiar with, the COP process, as they call it. So hopefully we'll get a response from the Scottish Government, and it won't just be something that's nicely produced and glossy, but will actually be a response that is thoughtful as the members' efforts were in putting together this report. So that's what we're waiting for next. And let's hope that the excellent report from the members does provide the policymakers with a bit of courage here to move forward. And not least, I think one area we haven't touched on, just to make sure we don't leave that elephant in the room, is what we're going to do with Scotland's that the UK would like to think it belongs to the UK, but with Scotland's oil and gas industry. That is a real challenge and one that Scotland has really got to grapple with. And there was, the members did talk about the idea about the rapid shift away from fossil fuels, from oil and gas, but that this has to be done in a just and fair way. And so I think that's a really important key issue that the Scottish government cannot ignore.
Yeah, I mean, Colin Wheel's a member of the Just Transition Partnership up in up here in Scotland, where we've been advising and feeding into the discussions around how that transition takes place. Because one thing Scotland has certainly learned from our own history is from things like deindustrialization and the decline of the coal industry is that a lot of communities who relied on those sectors have in the past simply been abandoned, and that cannot happen again.
No. And of course, they're not just abandoned at that time, but as we've seen with a lot of the mining communities, those communities are wrecked for generations to come, for decades to come. So it's absolutely key that's not the case. But I think we also have to realize what we're up against here. I mean, the UK government's own oil and gas authority, this is the UK government's oil and gas authority, as its opening statement makes this claim that we work with industry and government to maximize the economic recovery of oil and gas and support the UK government in its drive to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. I mean, that is an oxymoron if ever you saw one. They're completely incompatible. And the Scottish government is going to have to tackle that if it's going to be serious about climate change.
Yeah, at some point, the planet stops caring about your profit margins.
It does. And again, that's a wonderful thing about this report from the members. I mean, they kept pointing out that, that welfare, well-being and so forth has to go alongside, and sometimes even trump issues to do with profit. So that whole sort of political agenda, which I was very surprised to see emerging, had a very strong consensus amongst this very disparate group of Scottish citizens.
So I guess this is the challenge for the politicians, for the Scottish government, who will be responding to the report. As you say, not to waste this opportunity and to waste the effort that has gone into this, to really take seriously these policy recommendations and hopefully to adopt as many of them as they can.
Yes, yeah, but also not to use them as, this assembly was not there just to provide piecemeal policies that the government could then adopt. It was there to provide an overview of the sorts of things that the Scottish society is prepared to accept and is expecting the policymakers to deliver on. So it must not be used as an excuse for policymakers not delivering on other things that weren't necessarily covered by the Scottish members in the assembly. So it must be seen as a holistic document that sets a sort of a sense of direction for the government, as well as the actual policy recommendations themselves.
Well, Kevin, I think we can't finish on a better note than that. So, Kevin, thank you for coming on to the podcast today. It's been a fantastic chat with you. And just to finish up, as I always do, by reminding listeners that Commonweal is an organisation that is entirely funded by folk like yourselves who donate on an average of about £10 a month. We don't have government funding. We don't have corporate sponsors. We don't even have adverts on our website. Everything we do, from producing our policies to the public outreach that we do to this podcast, is all supported by folk like yourselves. So if any of you can support us and help us carry on with our work, we greatly appreciate it. And with that, I'll be back next week.